with Donald Burleson. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've written a new book, UFOs and the Murder of Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
Can you tell us basically what got your interest in the subject?
Well, actually, I've been so intensely interested in this subject for so long, it's almost hard to remember exactly what the initial impetus was. I think certainly the surfacing of the famous CIA document about Marilyn being, you know, under surveillance, and the obvious official act about her diary and about her having essentially derived secret information from the Kennedys in the course of tryst with them. That document certainly piqued my interest, and since then, of course, I've seen other documents and other kinds of information, and I have read, of course, the mainstream material on Marilyn's death with, of course, a different kind of eye, you know, being a UFO investigator and being familiar with these documents, which, you know, do not actually surface a whole lot in the mainstream literature.
By looking at your book, I understand that the document suddenly appeared at a UFO investigator's and a famous writer's house.
Yeah, it's a little bizarre how the story trying to track the initial appearance of that document. You know, there are different the Stephen Greer people, you know, in the Disclosure Project, you know, say that it came to them fairly early on, around 1994, I believe, and it is said to have surfaced earlier in California. And you know, the story is a little convoluted, but we do know that it did appear and has every appearance of being a legitimate document. And as I was telling you before, I have done a great deal of Freedom of Information Act activity with the CIA over this, and I initially asked them for transcripts of the wiretaps being done on Marilyn's phone at the time of her death. They denied that they had any, which is pretty strange when you read a document, because the document makes it very clear that not only were there wiretaps, but there was a great deal of official anxiety about their content. That initial request was denied. They said they didn't have any such records, and when I appealed it, I based the appeal primarily on the famous August 3rd, 1962 CIA Marilyn Monroe document, and the appeal was accepted. In my book, that acceptance of an appeal based on a document is a form of authentication. And, you know, as the Stephen Greer people have said, you know, other documents, experts have done authentication work on it too. So it is a linchpin in the investigation. It's what got me mostly interested in it, and I think a great deal depends on it. And as I said in the book, I've also made a discovery about a sort of bleed-in on the top of the document that I think pretty well nails things down.
Yeah, that leads back to your real job, or your 9-to-5 job. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I'm the director of a computer lab, and I'm constantly surrounded with hardware and software. I've got every kind of imaging software there is, you know, and it's a good setting. It's a frustrating place to work sometimes, but it's a good place to be in some ways, because I have all the hardware and software around me you could possibly want. And, of course, I've actually got a great deal of the stuff at home, too. I was in my lab one day, and a student worker in there named James Shoemaker looked at I had the CIA document on the screen, and she looked at one spot just over to the left of the top secret stamp, and she said, "Isn't there kind of a shadow there, as if something had been written or typed there?" And I said, "Well, I think you're right. I think there's something there, but, you know, there are several of us looking at it. Nobody could really see anything, and we couldn't make anything out of it." But I immediately started putting it through enhancement procedures with some of the software I have, and I did kind of a colorizing wash on it, and well, lo and behold, what that shadow is that Jane saw there is an imprint of the name of General George Shulgin, Brigadier General Shulgin, and it goes on to say, you know, this exhibit includes the intelligence collection memorandum. Which is, people in the UFO field know about this. General Shulgin was at one time the chief of the Air Requirement Division of Army Air Corps Intelligence. In fact, at the time of the Roswell incident, he was the chief UFO investigator of an organization which has no such creature, namely the United States Air Force.
Right.
And to me, all of a sudden, seeing Shulgin's name on the top of the CIA document about Marilyn Monroe was just, I just almost fell on the floor when I saw his name on there. The intelligence collection memorandum, of course, is a real item, and it all sort of hangs together. Whatever explains this, the simple fact is those things, some exhibit on the intelligence collection memorandum and the Marilyn Monroe CIA document were filed together by someone at some time.
Does this relate to the Project Moondust that you mentioned in your book?
Well, that's somehow involved, because in fact the phrase Moondust appears in the subject line of the, it says project, it says Moondust as a stamp, you know, followed by the word project in the upper right of the document. And of course, you know, I think everyone pretty well knows Moondust is an organization that's been around since at least 1953. Kevin Randall has written a book about it on the basically on the activity of chasing down and retrieving and working with alien spacecraft debris. All these things pretty well hang together. Somebody thought it all related enough to make a big, you know, common file of it somewhere, evidently.
Exactly. I think we all have read or seen documentaries on the fact that Marilyn basically seemed to be in love with both John and Robert Kennedy.
Yeah.
And I guess it follows that pillow talk, whatever, there were secrets revealed to her that the government at the time certainly did not want revealed.
That's true. That's true. In fact, I think very little has been said. I did say it in this book, but I think heretofore very, very little has been said about the real, real gravity of the possible consequences had Marilyn done what they were afraid she was going to do and what she was threatening to do, which was to have a press conference on the following Monday morning. That would have been August 6th, 1962, if she had lived that long. She was going to have a press conference and, quote, tell all, unquote. And I think the Kennedys had a real anxiety about what she meant by telling all. In the book, essentially, I've explored the notion that, in any case, they couldn't afford to take any chances. They had to assume a worst-case scenario, and the worst case would have been pretty ugly, because when you get right down to it, especially in a political climate like the summer of 1962, when we thought we were about to go to war with the Soviet Union over the Cuban Missile Crisis, imparting classified information to someone not entitled to receive it is a very serious offense. You know, if you're a government official and you get charged with a thing like that, you're in a lot of trouble, and it's quite conceivable that under the circumstances, John Kennedy could have been charged with treason. In fact, his brother, the Attorney General, would have had to prosecute him, which of course was unthinkable. He would have had to appoint a special prosecutor, I think. And it was going to be a no-win situation for them, because, you know, if he were charged with treason and if they got a conviction, you know, well, then of course the presidency's down the drain and so forth. If they didn't get a conviction, everybody would say, sure, you know, your brother's the Attorney General, of course you weren't convicted. But in any case, think about this. How would it have been possible to prosecute that case and say, look, you know, the president is accused of imparting classified information, to wit, you know, the government has been sitting on classified items, UFO debris, possibly UFO bodies, for a number of years. How could they have prosecuted that case and not admit that what Marilyn had said was true, if that's what she said?
Yeah, really, they couldn't have.
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, they couldn't have.
Yeah, I mean, she was a popular person. You know, you don't get 1,000 pieces of fan mail a day because people hate you. You know, I mean, if she had stepped up to those microphones that Monday morning, it's possible she would have just said, "Hey, these guys slept with me, you know, and it really ticks me off, and now they're giving me the stiff arm treatment and everything." But you know, I don't think they could have. That's all she was going to say.
Yeah, that would embarrass them. But so what?
Yeah, exactly. The Kennedys never cared what people thought of them. It never mattered.
No, and both.
I mean, the Kennedys keep getting elected. I mean, you know, even after Chappaquiddick, you know, Teddy kept getting. No, they've never cared, or it hasn't mattered what they've done. You know, they keep getting elected and keep being popular. But if if Marilyn Monroe had stepped up to a bunch of microphones and said, "Okay, here it comes, folks," and had said, in effect, you know, "John Kennedy told me things that amount to an act of treason," because she wouldn't have put it that way, but I think the Department of Justice would have put it that way.
Certainly. Can you tell us about an interview that took place with Marilyn's boyfriend in 1982?
Yeah, actually, let's see, it was 1983, actually. A few months before she died, Marilyn met a Mexican screenwriter and movie director named Jose Bolaños. She was making some trips to Mexico. She had just bought a little house out in Brentwood, and she was furnishing it Mexican style, and she was going down there and buying furniture, and she was having the floor tiled and, you know, whatnot. And in one of her trips, she had met, in late February, early March, sometime around about there, she met this fellow named Jose Bolaños and really kind of fell for him. He was kind of a ladies' man. He was dashing and debonair, and she really kind of went. She was robbing the cradle a little bit, actually. He was 10 years younger than she, and he kind of followed her back to the U.S. He ended up taking her to the Golden Globe Awards in March of 62, just a few months before she died, and they kind of, you know, saw each other off and on, and depending on who you talk to, it either was or wasn't serious. Some people said, you know, it was no big deal, and other people said, well, they might have gotten married if she had lived. But he was one of the last people to call her that night, one of the last people to talk to her. And 21 years later, in 1983, after her death, Jose Bolaños was interviewed by Anthony Summers. And Summers, somehow, I've never seen the whole transcript of that interview, but somehow in the interview it came out that they of course talked about the fact that Bolaños had called Marilyn, you know, just a few minutes, maybe 30 minutes before she died. And he said, Marilyn told me something that night that will one day shock the whole world. And I think the choice of verb tense is interesting. We're talking 1983 here. He said, will one day shock the whole world. Something that at that point, 21 years later, had not come out. Now, alternative explanations like, you know, Marilyn knew that JFK was planning to assassinate Castro. Marilyn knew, of course, you know, Marilyn had affairs with Kennedys. Marilyn knew, you know, things about the Bay of Pigs and so forth. All of that stuff had long since been declassified. And so when you think about it, for Bolaños to say, and he wouldn't tell Anthony Summers what it was. Summers asked him, of course. He said, no, I can't tell you. I can't talk about it.
Do you think
Summers knew?
No.
My hypothesis is that Marilyn told him the big one, you know, the big secret, and that's the sort of thing that would shock the whole world. I mean, you got to remember, we're not talking about, you know, an affair with some politicians. I mean, that's the sort of thing that certainly wouldn't shock Jose Bolaños. I mean,
talking about Roswell.
He was a ladies' man himself. Yeah, I think that Marilyn says something to him to the effect, John Kennedy told me about a crashed flying saucer, you know, about alien bodies that he went out to see, you know, and now that would shock the whole world, certainly. And when you think about it, too, this was 21 years after he talked to Marilyn the night of her death. Can you remember any telephone conversation you had word for word that long ago?
No.
Whatever it was, it was pretty striking.
That's right. I've heard, or I saw it on TV, something to the effect that, I don't know if it was Marilyn Monroe, but one of the presidents actually took a movie star out to Area 51.
Well, it wasn't Marilyn.
No, it was the girl from the Poseidon Adventure, the heavy girl.
Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't.
Yeah,
it wasn't,
whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't Marilyn. Some people have actually said that, kind of, I don't know, like sort of rereading the CIA document dyslexically, I guess. You know, some people have kind of said that it says that JFK showed her, you know, body at a secret airbase or something. But it doesn't say that. You know, what it says is Marilyn had secrets, and one of the secrets had to do with the visit by the president at a secret airbase for the purpose of viewing things from outer space, or inspecting things from outer space.
So it could have been Wright Patterson. It could have been anywhere.
Yeah, but in any case, it was just the president telling her things, not taking her and showing her. I doubt very seriously that the president could have gotten through, let's say, to the blue room at Wright Pat, you know, with anybody with him.
That's right.
In fact, he'd be lucky if he got in there himself.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been to my website, UFO Digest.
Yeah,
there's,
yeah.
Okay, there's an article on there about the death of Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
And I got an email a week ago, I think, from a gentleman in the U.S., and he was very, very upset with me. for trying to do anything to dispel the idea that Marilyn's death was a suicide.
Well, Marilyn's death was very definitely not a suicide. I mean, Donald Wolfe, in his biography, The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe, goes into great detail about the blood chemistry thing, and I kind of repeat that with some, I kind of put it together a slightly, with a little bit different spin, but more or less the same kind of information. The blood chemistry is all wrong for suicide. When Marilyn's blood was analyzed, she had 4.5 milligrams percent pentobarbital and 8.0 milligrams percent chloral hydrate in her blood. That'd kill a whole room full of people. And the problem with trying to do that swallowing Nimbutal tablets is that you'd have to take roughly somewhere between 80 and 100 of them to do that. And by the time you take about 20 Nimbutal tablets, you're dead.
Yeah, there'd be some residue left in
there. There would be residue. And indeed, whatever stuff you gulp down last, it would stop being absorbed from the digestive tract into the blood. As soon as the heart stops, all the absorption stops. And basically, not only would there be residue, but you would essentially have your blood toxicity, you know, your toxic density of your blood fall a lot short of what hers was.
Right.
You can't do that to your blood by taking pills or by being given an enema. You know, the only thing that can do that is direct hot injection.
Right, to the bloodstream, you mean?
Yeah, she sure as hell didn't do that to herself.
I found your book very fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
When the doctor appeared on the scene, there was a big controversy. When did she die, 10 o'clock at night or 4 o'clock the next morning?
Right.
And it seemed like it was just a comedy of errors.
Oh, yeah.
The doctor tried to revive her and did, and then had to kill her again or...
Right. Well, he actually said to the ambulance driver, "I'm going to have to make a show of this." It's kind of a strange thing to say, you know, when
right.
you think about it. The ambulance driver remembers him saying that.
But he actually succeeded.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, it's pretty easy to fix the time of Marilyn's death at slightly before 11 o'clock because...
all the evidence in your book.
Yeah, the Jacobs pair, you know, Natalie and Jacobs, actually it was Natalie Trundy at the time. She was his fiancée. They were married a little later. They were at Henry Mancini concert at the Hollywood Bowl, and before the concert was over, because Natalie remembers that it was still running, you know, I mean, Henry Mancini's band was still up there playing on the stage, Arthur got a note in their box, you know, from one of those runners, you know, who bring messages to people at events like that, and it said that, you know, you'd better come, you know, Marilyn has died of an overdose, and, Arthur just got up and left, you know. And the thing is, we know that that had to be before 11 o'clock because there's a
curfew.
There's an ordinance in Los Angeles that public concerts at the Bowl have to be over by 11 because there's residential streets nearby. You know, I mean, there are people living nearby, so they have to cut the noise out by 11, you know, p.m. So not only was Marilyn dead by 11 p.m., but a lot of people knew about it. And Arthur went to her house, and later Natalie didn't see him for a few days. And later, when she finally caught back up with him, all he said to her was, "You know, I had to kind of fudge the whole thing."
Right. Can you skip ahead? I guess to the most important part for our listeners is basically, how do you think Marilyn died, and who did it?
Well, basically, the evidence is something like this. That we have essentially evidence from the son-in-law of Marilyn's housekeeper, Eunice Murray. He was Norman Jeffries, and he was interviewed when he was in a terminal illness in the early 90s. And he and Eunice remembered Bobby and two people coming to the house around 10 o'clock. And see, they had been there before that day. There had been a big row over the house that day, which I think is what led to some of the anxiety over this. In other words, like it's now or never, you know, I think is what was going through Bobby's head probably. Because Bobby had a big fight with her. He was looking for the diary, for one thing. She wouldn't give it to him, and she was screaming out about he had promised to marry her and so on. I think he backed off. Oh, you know, she's so ticked at me now that she may not wait till Monday to have the press interview, you know, but that press conference. But
just stop there for a second.
Okay.
Quite a few people know about this press conference.
Well, not a whole. whole lot of, well, some, a few people, I wouldn't say a whole lot of people knew. The people that weren't supposed to know, because she had talked about it on the phone. Well, I think one of the things I said in the book is, too bad she didn't just do it, you know, it just didn't happen.
She'd be alive today.
Yeah, but when she talked about it on the phone, that was the fatal mistake. And I really think that they kind of saw the old proverbial handwriting on the wall. And what happened around 10 that evening is that Norman and his mother-in-law remembered, how could you forget, Kennedy and two other guys coming to the door and just ordering them out of the house for the second time that day. They were a little gentler about it the first time. They just said, why don't you guys go shopping? We'd like to talk to Marilyn. That was in the afternoon. When they came at 10 o'clock, they said, get the hell out of the house. We'll talk Marilyn along.
Right, right.
And this time they went to a neighbor's house and just kind of sat with their elbows up on the kitchen windowsill, you know, and watched Marilyn's house. And around 10:30, and also, by the way, Elizabeth Pollard, who was one of the neighbors of Marilyn, remembers Bobby and two guys going into the house. Around 10:30, Norman saw the three guys come out. And so they figured, well, the coast is clear. They went back over there. The door of the guest cottage was open. Her dog, Moth, that was short for Mafia, it was a gift from Frank Sinatra, was barking, and they went into the guest cottage, and Marilyn was lying on the floor, still alive, but not by much, dying. And, well, what can I say? People saw, Bobby and two guys go into the house. People saw Bobby and two guys come out of the house, and they walk over there and find Marilyn dying. I mean, what would you think? You know, I mean...
One of us, too.
Yeah, and it's not, I'm not saying that, you know, I really doubt very seriously that Bobby Kennedy would even know how to use it, how to determine evil with it, with his skill. But one of the guys with him was carrying a black medical bag. See, we don't really still know. Some people think that the two people were maybe Dr. Engelberg and Dr. Greenson, but I'm inclined to wonder. It may have been just some of Bobby's people, you know.
Right, right.
So we don't know who did what, but we know the three people went in, we know the three people came out, and we know that Marilyn was dying just minutes after that. That's all easy to pin down time-wise because of the concert at the Hollywood Bowl.
Right, right. Bobby Kennedy.
Well, he was there. He was involved. I never trusted him. I mean, what can I say? You know, I was always astonishing to me that people thought of him as the political darling of the college crowd and so on in the 60s when he was running for presidency. I remember this guy when he was a special investigator for the McCarthy witch hunt, you know, and I never thought of him the same way, you know. He was a ruthless guy. He was brilliant. He was well-educated, and he was unprincipled. And that's a dangerous kind of person.
This interview could go on for hours. Literally, I would like to spend that much time speaking with you. Maybe we can do it again soon one day.
Yeah.
I'd really enjoy it.
Oh, I'd love to.
I will have this interview on the website within the next 2 days.
That's great.
And I'd like to say thank you very much for the interview.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it. My pleasure.